Very good morning to everyone. The first case on this morning's call is number 02-1302, Larry D. Hennings against United Suppliers. And Mr. Stein.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Kevin Stein. I represent Larry and Marissa Hennings, the debtors in a bankruptcy case that was filed in the Central District of Illinois. This case essentially involves two different bankruptcy cases, one that was filed by Hennings Feed and Crop Care Incorporated, which was a corporation that was owned by Larry Hennings, and then an individual case filed by Larry and Marissa Hennings. The individual case was filed in December of 1999. The corporate case was filed in August of 1999.
Mr. Stein, forgive me for interrupting you so early in your argument, but why doesn't the record contain the transcript of the hearing on the settlement, which would allow us to review that decision?
Your Honor, I requested all the transcripts, and quite honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if there was any transcript. I know that I wasn't at the hearing because we had fully negotiated a settlement. We put it all, a lengthy settlement agreement, down in paper, and counsel for the creditors were merely going to present it to the judge, and we thought it was going to be entered. And my understanding of what happened at the hearing is the judge just appeared and said, I'm not approving the settlement, and that's all there was to it.
So your understanding is there was no oral statement made by the court as to the reasons for rejecting it?
That's correct. But I was not there. That's based on what I was told by counsel.
And is it your position that the court has to have written findings?
I don't think the court has to have written findings, no.
And can you explain why you think approval of the settlement would have been in the best interest of all the creditors, not just the three main creditors?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, I believe because an objection to discharge is an uphill battle. It's a tough burden for creditors to meet. It turns out in this case that the judge had found that the creditors met their burden. But I think initially it's a tough case to make. We were at the initial stages. We hadn't really done any trial preparation up till this point. But I think the biggest concern is that the creditors and the trustee wanted cooperation in going after some of the chemical companies. They thought they had cause of action against the chemical companies. And by my client agreeing to waive his rights under the Fifth Amendment, they could obtain his cooperation and pursue those claims against the chemical companies. And that's how they could maximize money to be distributed to the other creditors of the estate. My clients don't have any money. My clients are individuals that don't even work. They don't have any money. The only chance they have of getting money out of my clients right now are to garnish their wages, and they're probably exempt from garnishment with what they make. I know they're not paying me, so I don't know. I mean, they don't have any money. So I think that the decision that was made that was not only the best interest of these creditors but all the creditors is let's get him to waive his Fifth Amendment privileges. First of all, he wanted to tell us what you know, which we did. They heard what he had to say, and they said, okay, we're going to reach this agreement. You waive your Fifth Amendment privileges, totally cooperate with us. We're going to go after the chemical companies and try and collect the money to distribute to the creditors of this estate. That's why I think it's in the best interest of all the creditors. And Your Honor, I know there are only three creditors here, but these three creditors are about $15 million represented. So I would urge that that's the bulk of the creditors in this estate. There are other creditors, obviously, but $15 million is a lot of creditors that were involved in this.
And how much is involved with the other creditors?
Your Honor, I don't remember, to be honest with you, no. But basically, I think that the issue here is that the judge never did give any reasons as to why this settlement agreement was not approved. The judge disappeared at the hearing and said, I'm not approving this settlement agreement. Now, I'm sure he had read it. I don't know what reasons he had because we don't have a record of them, and he never gave any reasons to my knowledge. He just said he wasn't going to approve it. I think if he would have applied the DePoister test and applied it with the facts that were known at that time, he would have approved the settlement agreement. It's kind of hard to send it back to him now and ask him to apply DePoister because he's already heard all the evidence and the creditors have already won. But I think if he would have applied DePoister with the facts that were known at that time, he would approve the settlement agreement. And quite frankly, I thought he would approve it. We had three bankruptcy lawyers that are very well respected in the Central District. That's what they do. They're three of the top lawyers in the Central District. We had two of the creditors are large corporations that are sophisticated in these type of things. And it wasn't simply a matter of me as debtor's counsel taking advantage of some lawyers who didn't know what they were doing. These lawyers know what they're doing. Their clients are involved in this stuff every day, and it was a long, drawn-out settlement. It was a detailed settlement because we wanted to tell the court everything that was involved, and we thought it was going to be approved.
Let me ask you, because you put your finger on another issue here. I mean, what kind of relief are you actually seeking with respect to this particular claim? As you mentioned, that he rejected the settlement. He's heard now the evidence. What would you want us to do?
I would ask that you reverse and then approve the settlement agreement.
Let me take you on a different path for just a moment, please. Even if the Hennings, even if the Hennings commingle funds,
yeah,
and use personal funds for the corporation, wasn't that taken into consideration when the trustee concluded that they took out $180,000 more than they put into the corporation in the year that the company went into bankruptcy?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor, because the trustee at that time did not have the debtor's checking account information. They didn't have the check registers. What happened was, it was terrible bookkeeping, but the debtors would, because the corporation had reached its loan limit at the local bank, the debtors would get personal loans and put that money into the corporation. So let's use $180,000 as an example. The debtors would borrow $180,000 from their local bank, deposit that into the corporation, or put it into their personal bank account and pay corporate debts. Then that loan would become due a year later, and the debtors would take $180,000 out of the corporation, write themselves a check for $180,000, put loan on it. Well, the debtor's testimony was that note was to them that it was used to repay a loan. They would then take that $180,000, repay the bank loan that was a personal loan but was borrowed for the benefit of the corporation.
Will the record tell us whether the Hennings were educated people?
I think it should, yes. They were not educated at all. They were, I think if you read the record and the testimony of the Hennings, it's clear that they are not educated people. And I know that if you read the judge's order, it makes Judge Hennings sound Larry Hennings sound sophisticated, but I can tell you, Judge, that he's not. If you read the record, I think it's pretty clear that he has a hard time understanding questions you ask him and a hard time giving an answer. He talks a lot, but he's not educated at all, no, and I think you can glean that from the record.
What I think I have gleaned from portions of the record that I've read is that the judge thought he and Mrs. Henning were obfuscating, shall we say?
I think that he thought that is a fair statement of what Judge Lesson felt, that he thought that they were avoiding every question and either directly lying or avoiding the answers. That was what he thought. That's true. And I know I've got an uphill battle on that because he's the finder of facts, and But I don't think that there's anything in the record that would show that they were sophisticated or that they were business people or that they were CPAs. These were people who quite honestly, what I think happened, Judge, is that they started a little business. Things were going good. The chemical companies came to them and said, hey, we'll give you these rebates. You can increase these sales on these drop shipments. The money starts flowing, and he's living the big life, and he thinks, you know, my sales went up $10 million this year, so I must be doing better. Probably his biggest mistake was not having a CPA in there in the first place to make sure things were taken care of. But, Judge, he had no incentive to steal anything from the corporation because he had guaranteed most of the corporate debt.
Well, he is the corporation.
That's
basically
right. Why steal from it?
I don't know.
The other thing I want to point out on the settlement is that it appeared to me that the circuit judge, when she upheld the appeal, applied a per se test that basically said the judge didn't really give any reasons as to why he did not deny approval of the settlement agreement. The judge didn't set forth any reasons at all, but this is against public policy, so he doesn't need to. And Judge, I don't think that's the right test for this court to adopt. I think we ought to allow cases like this to be settled for several reasons. First of all, in this case, the circuit court held the debtor didn't give up anything of value. The debtor gave up their Fifth Amendment right. That's a cherished right in the United States. He gave that up, and it was a big risk giving that up. He gave that up, and that's, I think that's proper in a bargain. The second effect, if you have a per se rule, you're going to have a chilling effect on filing any objection to discharge. If I represent a creditor before I file any type of objection to discharge, I'm going to think long and hard about it, because I know once I do, I lose control over the case, and I'm not going to be able to settle it. Also, it causes parties to waste time and expense on litigation. It's almost, if you adopt the per se test, once you file it, you have to try it. The other thing before, and I know I'm running into my time, but that I want to talk about is the failure to explain the loss of corporate assets within 1 year. That was another basis for denying the debtor's discharge. And I think there's some confusion, maybe on my part, maybe on the court's part, as to what the one-year period applies to. Judge Lesson felt the one-year period applies to failure to give the explanation. In other words, I didn't explain what happened to him within 1 year of my bankruptcy. I don't think that's the right explanation of the statute. I think the one-year period refers to failure to explain the loss of assets within 1 year. In other words, the corporation filed bankruptcy in August of 99. So you look back 1 year and you ask the insiders, explain to us what happened to these corporate assets in the year before filing. Judge Lesson's taken the approach that that's not the time frame. The time frame is that the debtor's failure to give the explanation within 1 year. If that's the correct reading, then I would submit that any dishonest debtor could simply file bankruptcy for a corporation, wait 1 year and 1 day to file their own bankruptcy, and then they don't have to give an explanation. I don't think that's the intent. I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. If there are any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. We'll hear now from Mr. Richardson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jeff Richardson, and I represent Roger Stone, who is the Chapter 11 trustee for Hennings Seed and Crop Care, the company. He's not the trustee for Mrs. Hennings.
Could I just start you out?
Sure.
What evidence was presented that the depletion of assets occurred within the one-year period?
Your Honor, you had the balance sheets that were done by Mose, Lively, Yockey, and Ford, who were the accountants that CPA Mr. Hennings used. My recollection, and I haven't reread the record, was there were about three balance sheets done in the year that preceded the bankruptcy. The first balance sheet from Mose, Lively showed that the company had a net worth of, I think, something between $1 million and $1.5 million. They then revised that balance sheet to say, no, you've really got a negative net worth of about $1 million or $1.5 million, and by the time the axe fell on the company, that negative net worth turned out to be $12, $13, $14 million.
Yeah, but what evidence during that one year period?
I think the primary thing that concerned Judge Lesson, Your Honor, was that, as I recall, that there were about $30 million of sales, all it lost. Or the majority of them at loss, maybe 70-80% of them, where they were selling these assets to basically wholesalers. In other words, Mr. Justice's client, United Suppliers, would sell Hennings and send him a bill for $100,000 worth of assets that Mr. Hennings would immediately then turn around and sell for $70,000. And the judge's question was, why? Explain it. Mr. Hennings' explanation was, well, it's very simple. I'm going to get it all down the road. But in fact, that was never shown. He did make some money by basically siphoning off money for himself. He created these mailboxes for his kids where they had the chemical companies send rebates, but nothing really ever added up. And I think in that year, that was Judge Lesson's ultimate conclusion. The bankruptcy judge is, you've given me some explanation, but you haven't gotten there.
So there was specific evidence that there were some below-cost sales as well as that $180,000 loan during that relevant time.
Yes, Your Honor. The sales were in the record, and the trustee came up, and I think we actually quoted that language. I think it was in my brief to the district court. And the trustee, who is a CPA, said, I've looked. I've tried to figure it out. Nothing's ever added up. I think I asked him, or one of the other attorneys asked him, did they provide explanations? And he said, yes, nothing that never made any sense. And in essence, that's what Judge Lesson said, the bankruptcy judge. Your explanations don't make any sense.
Well, was there any finding by the court that the debtors personally benefited by selling to the brokers at 30% below cost?
No, I think what Judge, I don't recall that that was part of the court's order. I think what the court indicated in that aspect of the case, Your Honor, was that the debtors breached their fiduciary duty because there was no reasonable corporate purpose that the court could perceive to basically lose money on the majority of the transactions unless you were just getting your money for yourself.
Well, then, you know, let's see, you're from Southern Illinois. Okay.
Well, I consider it Central Illinois.
I'm trying to think of, you know, some places that you, I mean, like then, places like Costco, they sell 30% under, 40% under, 50% under.
Yeah. Here's what Hennings did, Your Honor. Anybody that runs a business has two components. You got to pay for the product and you got to pay for the overhead. Hennings was paying for the product at $100,000 for product A and was selling it to these brokers for $70,000 without considering the overhead. It was a massive sham, okay? And they weren't, you know, Mr. Stein tries to portray these people as poor business people, but basically they were dishonest. And if you want some examples of that, you can look at these phony accounts where they pretend their children who are 8 and 10 are a management company. Now, that's not a function of not having a college degree. That's a function of being a crook, okay? And you don't have to have a college degree not to be dishonest. And that was the problem. The problem that was facing Mr. Stone and really the other parties here were really at the outset of Hennings Feed and Crop Care. Company files bankruptcy. They want to reorganize. The Chicago attorneys withdraw almost immediately. Okay, they don't even get to the first meeting of creditors. They're out the door. Mr. and Mrs. Hennings are removed as debtors in possession within a month. There's no information to base this what happened here. And Mr. Hennings and Mrs. Hennings are not talking. They're not talking in their corporate bankruptcy. They're not talking in their personal bankruptcy. It was a bitter pill to swallow, but my client, who felt his interests were to try and find out if there were assets here for the company, if there were people to pursue, how these losses occurred, felt that getting the information was important. And we tried to detail this agreement in great length to tell the judge why we were trying to do it, but everybody, me in particular, I think, knew that there was a real possibility Judge Lesson was going to say, I'm not going to approve this.
Since you're on the settlement,
yes,
what would happen if we remanded the case for reconsideration of the settlement? Would it still be binding if it were approved? What's your position on that?
Well, I suppose the court could do that. I think the court could say there was an error committed and we've got to go back to square one in terms of considering the settlement.
Do you accept the characterization that hearing was simply an announcement of the judge's decision?
No, Your Honor. My recollection of what happened was this. In early December, Judge Lesson, the bankruptcy judge, had scheduled a conference call to pick a trial date. And I believe that conference call was to around December 7th, I think.
Is that on the record?
Yes, I think it is in the docket. And then the record will show that conference call is canceled and that all of us were told to come to Springfield to consider this settlement. Now, this was not an evidentiary hearing, and Judge Lesson did indicate, my recollection was, he was not going to approve the settlement. And my recollection is that Judge Lesson had concerns about the gravity of the allegations that were made against Mr. and Mrs. Hennings, and whether this was the type of settlement he should be considering in the first place.
So why didn't you order the transcript?
Well, Your Honor, in retrospect, writing up here with Mr. Justice yesterday, I think there's a lot of things that would have clarified this. Maybe
yes.
A written order would have helped.
Well, and also, even if we didn't have a written order, a transcript
would certainly
shed some light. So I was curious.
Sure.
I understand the appellant didn't ask. So I didn't understand why you didn't ask.
Well,
because my assumption was, since you didn't ask, that the court just said settlement is not approved. So there was nothing that would be helpful to you in terms of the dialogue at that hearing.
The only thing that would be helpful, this was not a hearing where evidence was presented.
I understand.
It was very obvious to all of us that Judge Lesson had considered the agreement, and it was a detailed agreement. And he came in and indicated his feelings as to the agreement. I don't know that there would have been much more in a transcript, but in retrospect, although I think it's always the appellant's primary obligation, it would have probably been better if we got that to you.
Forgive me, was this in chambers?
No, Your Honor. It was in court.
It was an open court.
Yes. Yeah.
So there was a court reporter.
Yes, Your Honor.
Present.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So there's somewhere.
All right.
So that could be ordered.
Yes, and if I can finish on the settlement agreement, basically what we had, and the reason it was, and Mr. Justice, are you willing to defer? All right. You've got a number of cases when we presented this to court, we all knew about them, that said this just violates public policy. You've got other cases that say this is really suspicious under public policy, but there may be valid reasons. This court has never ruled on the issue, but it did rule in the case of N. Ray Scott, which we cite in our brief, and it says complete financial disclosure is the condition precedent to discharge. If you take this agreement that we presented to the court, and you take it down to its basics, Larry and Marissa Hennings were saying is, we will agree to talk about our financial affairs if you, creditor and trustee on the other side, will go to the judge and get us remission for any non-dischargeable acts we would have committed. So if the court is not willing to adopt a per se rule and say, we just don't do these, we don't sell discharges, if you look at the four corners of this agreement and say, well, why would we approve an agreement where you folks are only doing what you have to do in exchange for absolution for all these other things that the court found you did. And so if you look at that agreement, I think if this court wants to say, we're not going to adopt an absolute rule, but on this agreement, it violates clear principles that this court has laid down. As to the trial itself, I'm not...
So if we took that tack, then your position would be there'd be no reason to remand it.
That's correct.
And in terms of getting the transcript, that wouldn't...
Yes, and Your Honor, I think part of the reason that there wasn't a lengthy hearing before Judge Lesson is we all went to great lengths in trying to lay out in that stipulation why we were attempting to do this. These people weren't talking. This is what we needed to know. This is what we're going to get. But in the bottom line is, what it really said is, no matter what bad, non-dischargeable things Mr. and Mrs. Hennings would have done, they're off the hook, if they'll talk. And this court has said, no, you disclose, period. That's your obligation. Not if the trustee gives you a good deal, not if the creditors give you adequate consideration. You fully disclose. That's your job as a debtor.
Is all of this an exercise in futility? Is everything here an exercise? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Are you talking about monetary recovery,
yeah.
Judge? I think that's the reason the settlement concept originally had some attractiveness, is all these millions of dollars were lost and gone. If they were buried in the backyard, we wanted to find them, okay? If there were people that got the money we could pursue, we wanted to go after them. I think everybody recognized Larry and Marissa Hennings weren't going to have $13 or $14 million in the rest of their lives. That's why it held some attractiveness. But that's the practical answer.
Mm-hmm.
The legal answer is Judge Lesson looked at this and said, in my opinion, these people are alleged to have done some very bad things. Discharge is only for people that Congress says haven't done very bad things. Congress doesn't say Congress says you get a discharge unless you've done A, B, and C. It doesn't say if you've done A, B, and C and then do something else, we'll forget about A, B, and C. And I think that's the essential problem that Judge Lesson had. I think Judge Scott agreed, the district court judge, when she said, this just violates public policy. I approve. So that's where we stand. May I answer any other questions? Mr. Justice, do you have any time left?
Well, Mr. Justice, how much time is left for that side? Well, you certainly can use that time then, sir.
One other thing I'd like to point out, because Mr. Barash is not here, and we point out in our brief, in the Band East issue where they say this is a false financial statement, 523, the appellants, Mr. and Mrs. Hennings, don't even argue in their appellate brief that there was any error committed in Judge Lessen's decision or Judge Scott's affirmance of that. It's another one of these things. I kind of like the transcript. I understand that it would have been better in the transcript to Mr. Justice, and I say, let's get it to him. But isn't the ultimate issue, isn't it the appellant's job to provide that record? Isn't the appellant's job to make that argument on appeal? Does Mr. Barash, for example, have to say, well, if Mr. and Mrs. Hennings were going to argue that the judgment in favor of my client was wrong, here's probably what they would say, and here's what my response is. That's simply not the way appeals work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richardson. How much time is left? There are 3 minutes, sir. If we have 3 minutes left on your side, Mr. Justice, you're certainly welcome to use those.
I represent United Suppliers, and the reason that I'm here is there was an allegation made in the briefs, an argument made, that we didn't reasonably rely upon the financial statements and the actual factual proof. It just was overwhelming that we did. The credit manager, the man who actually made the decision to lend these people another $9 million, drove 7 hours, met with Mr. Hennings, met with his banker, and looked at the financial statements. His handwritten notes on the day of the meeting are on the exhibit, and he then decides, okay, I'll sell you another $9 million. I don't know what more you can do to deal with Reliance. And that was a point that I wanted to emphasize on behalf of my client.
No auditing, I mean, just, okay, here's another $9 million. I mean, it seems so pro forma, doesn't it?
Unless you add one element, which is very common among credit managers. They went to the bank, they sat down with Mr. Hennings, his banker, and this credit manager, and they turned to the banker and said, is this guy solid? And the banker said yes. Credit managers in trade credit sales often rely upon the banker, especially in small towns where the bankers know what they're much more. They deal with these people on a daily basis. They know their accountants. They know their lawyers. Heck, Mr. Henning's lawyer was also the lawyer for the bank. I mean, they all know each other. And so they rely upon this guy's recommendation.
Is it your view that this is this giant conspiracy or that this is a bunch of fools? Or something in between? I don't...
Mr. and Mrs. Hennings clearly were working together to keep the cash flow going, to keep their lifestyle going. My time is up unless you have other questions.
Still have a minute.
1 minute.
All right, I'm sorry. And the, do I think there was a conspiracy between the bank and the accountants? No, that's not. But they went from a $2 or $3 million company selling chemicals to farmers to figuring out how to churn $30 million by selling product. And when you see $30 million going through your bank account, you can take a little off and put some in your kid's 401k account, your 9-year-old kid who is, quote, an employee and receiving 401k contributions. You could have your kid form a management company and get rebates. You can pay for your vet through the company. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. Mr. Stein, you have 2 minutes, sir.
First of all, Your Honor, on the Van Deest issue, we are not appealing the court's decision that the Van Deest debt is non-dischargeable. That's why it wasn't briefed. So we are not appealing that issue. On the United issue, I think the court hit the nail on the head, and that is that they did not rely on this financial statement. They never said they relied on it. If you look at the testimony, it was never asked, did you rely on this financial statement to make this loan? That question was never asked, and he never said that. What he did rely on is going to the bank and talking to the banker. He relied on his visual inspection of the premises.
If he would have been relying on the financial statement, why did he have to go talk to the banker? In fact, counsel just admitted that that's what they do. They go talk to the banker. They don't take these financial statements at face value.
Although, didn't the United Salesman testify he relied on the statement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't think he testified to that. I think he said it was given to him. He looked it over. He discussed it with Larry Henning. He then went to the bank and talked with the banker, and then he made a $9 million loan. Now, it can be implied from that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you could look on him going to the bank as just verification. That doesn't mean that he... That doesn't necessarily mean that he didn't rely on it, that that was part of what he took into account. He just wanted to have the bank verify
it. I agree. It doesn't necessarily mean he didn't, but it doesn't mean he did either, the way I read it. I want to talk about these quote, hidden accounts. These accounts had nothing to do with selling this chemical at a 30% discount. First of all, if you look at the record, there was evidence that he could sell at 30%. In fact, the trustee was asked in one instance alone whether there was over 30% collected back, and the trustee admitted there was. The difference, the change in circumstances over a year were because $7 million in chemical company receivables were written off. The trustee also admitted even though they were written off, they were later, several million of that had been collected. So I think they explained the difference. Part of the explanation was the financial statement was inaccurate. There was never $2 million worth of inventory there because a lot of this stuff was drop shipped, but it was kept on the books. There's nothing further on.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.